Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Shopping season has started, and we know what you want. An iPod. Even if you already have one, even if you have three. Those who have the iPod Nano want the iPod Video. Those who have the iPod Video can always think of some new accessory that they really, really need. Today, we talk to a man who loves his iPod more than all of us. So much so that he wrote a whole book about it. Stephen Levy is chief technology correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and he's the author of The Perfect Thing: How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Stephen, I like my iPod too, but I would hardly call it a perfect thing.
Well, I use the word perfect, not in the sense of flawless, because I think there are a couple of flaws in the iPod, but more in the perfect storm sort of way, because it really came together just at the time where technology made it possible, where the internet made music distribution possible, and where the efforts of this company, this cool company called Apple, was able to design things in a way to make everything simple and make everything really easy to use. So when you get the right song at the right time on your iPod, you just say perfect.
All right. So flaws, I mean, you know, the things do tend to break.
Yes.
Battery life has been problematic. You know, audiophiles are not happy with the sound quality. But there are also certain counterintuitive features to the iPod which seem to have worked out really well. Let's start with white. Basic white as the color scheme.
Right. Yeah. The designer, the industrial designer of the iPod, this guy named Jonathan Ive, who's sort of a design genius behind Apple's products, told me that it's shockingly neutral. And, you know, he just talks rhapsodically about the absence of color and this strong statement it makes. And it really does wind up to be sort of iconic, not only the color of the iPod, but the earbuds which come out of it, which identify you as a member of the iPod tribe, has turned out to be a strong statement and a branding mechanism for the iPod.
And as opposed to the fancy panels of blinking lights and switches and stuff, not even an on-off switch, just that round dial.
Right, yes. Now, Steve Jobs, who's the CEO of Apple and a guy who is pretty much a control freak and pretty much everything goes on in that company, he has an eye on. He is an utter minimalist in terms of design, and he wants simplicity. And the fewer buttons, the better. And he told his design team, he said, I don't want an on-off switch. And they looked at each other, well, what can we do here? And as it is, if you haven't quite cracked the code yet, you have to learn to hold the bottom button, the one south on the compass point where the wheel is on front, and just hold it down, and that turns it off. But actually, you know, Apple says you don't even have to turn it off. It goes into deeper stages of sleep if you leave it alone. So, you know, if you walk away, it's not churning out songs. It'll just go to sleep by itself.
Now, isn't it true that at some point early in the development of the iPod, they actually did add buttons or switches or something so that it wasn't just the wheel?
Right. Well, the very first concept had these buttons, and one was on, off, and there was no wheel. But in a very early design meeting, the meeting where they decided to go ahead with it, they brought in an outside guy to, you know, do some of the initial work to figure out how to put this stuff together in a package. And, you know, during that meeting, Apple's vice president of, you know, worldwide marketing had come up with his own idea about the wheel. You could, you know, sort of like move your finger around like a little hamster in a cage, right? And the quicker you moved it, it would really accelerate and go very fast, allowing you to scroll through many, many songs in a short period of time. And he introduced this element in, and that solved a lot of problems that you had in holding really a huge music library in your pocket. I mean, that was the big breakthrough of the iPod, really, the idea that you could carry around your whole music collection. Right. And there's the big question of, gee, how do you find the song you want? And this wheel made it really easy to get to the song you wanted in a big collection.
All right. We're speaking with Stephen Levy, chief technology correspondent of Newsweek, about his book, The Perfect Thing. One of the things that, you know, came together in this, as you call it, this perfect storm of confluences and influences that has turned iPod into what it is, an almost iconic part of the musical life these days, is the shuffle mode. Did that grab you right away? Did that grab, you know, the higher-ups at Apple right away? Was this something that people had to fight for?
It's kind of interesting because when you look back on the introduction of the iPod, they didn't make a big deal of the idea that you could shuffle your whole music collection. But, you know, somewhere buried in within two or three menus, there was a little button that says shuffle, and that would basically take all the songs in the iPod and shuffle them up like a blackjack dealer shuffles a deck of cards. And then it would come back at some sort of random order, ostensibly random order. And to me, that was what first wakened me to the idea that not only was this an interesting idea to get a lot of songs and carry it around with you, but it opened up new ways of listening to music. And that was what really created the first magic for me in the iPod when I got a lot of songs in it and was shuffling. You know, one day I walked into the subway and there came this song that I hadn't heard in a long time. I didn't remember even putting it on my iPod. It was My Back Pages. The Birds, the you know, the version there, and that had a lot of associations with me. It has a great sonic aspect to it, and it really made the subway, which is sort of a monochrome kind of place, burst into Technicolor. My associations and, you know, and the songs just really made
a little
my
psychedelic
rich.
Flashback right there on the 6 train or whatever,
something like that. Okay. And yeah, but then I realized, wow, this is my song. I hadn't planned on hearing that, but it was just great to hear it. And, you know, maybe there's a new way of listening to music here.
All right. So how soon after, I mean, you got your first iPod the day the iPods were released, October 23rd, 2001.
Correct.
It did not receive tumultuous applause at its unveiling at a, you know, big press conference and stuff. On the other hand, there were people who certainly were early adopters, and one of them at that first day there was a video presentation after Steve Jobs spoke, which included Moby telling people why he thought the iPod was great. What was that all about?
That's right. They had a few rock stars there on video to talk about their impressions of the iPod that they'd been seeing. And, you know, Moby, who was, at the time, was the hottest guy going. He had, you know, just multi-platinum CD. Remember CDs? and he was saying, you know, I can't believe this you can get your song from the computer to the iPod in like 10 seconds. That's unbelievable. And he just loved the design. He loved the whiteness of it. And, you know, that spoke to Moby, and he was very excited. And, you know, that day I actually talked to Steve Jobs, and I asked him what he was listening to in his iPod, and he said Moby.
Uh-huh. Probably this record, the hit Play. We are speaking with Stephen Levy about his book, The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness.
In the pouring rain, I watch hope come over me.
Moby, an early adopter of the iPod. Stephen Levy got his first iPod the day they were first made available. They were $399, which was, you know, why it was not met with universal acclaim. But
the other thing was that it only worked for Macintoshes back then.
Mm.
It was originally designed as something to get you to buy a Macintosh. One more reason to buy a Macintosh that, you know, there's a way to listen to music this way that you don't have with a Windows computer.
Right. Now, this was just about a month and a half after 9/11. Was that a coincidence, the timing of the release of the iPod?
Well, it was a coincidence in that, you know, it was under development then, but certainly, you know, 9/11 affected the way the iPod was rolled out. I think they were going to do a bigger event. During literally the day of 9/11, in my research, I found out that Jobs had written a letter to all the people at Apple saying, well, you don't have to come into work that day. And the people who were trying to get it out the door at that point, it was getting pretty late in the development process. They wanted to get out in time for the holiday. They didn't know what else to do. They came in and worked on it. And when I talked to Jobs on that day that he introduced it, he said, look, we asked ourselves, what can we do? And the only thing we could do is just go ahead with our plans and release it. Maybe it'll bring some joy to some people.
Mm-hmm. So coincidental to an extent, but it did seem to, you're saying it perhaps affected the way they marketed it initially and the whole rollout.
Right.
Maybe not as splashy as it otherwise would have been.
Absolutely. Okay. For Apple, it was a fairly low-key event on the campus of Apple Computer.
Right. So shortly after getting your first iPod, you write about having dinner with Bill Gates of Microsoft.
That's right. I got
What was his take?
Yeah, I got, so they came, you know, I didn't go to the event because I was not traveling. We were all sort of shocked at 9/11 at that point, if you remember. And, because we were working at Newsweek writing about terrorism and things. But they came and brought me one, which was nice. And you know, I quickly, you know, got some songs on it. And that night was the eve of the launch of the Microsoft operating system, Windows XP, which was coming out. And they had a small press dinner. And I sat next to Bill Gates during that dinner. And in the end, when people were getting up, I pulled my iPod out of my pocket and said, Bill, have you seen this? And he had heard about it, but not seen it. So he took it from me. And it was like one of those science fiction movies where an alien comes to Earth and has the ability to look at it at a human-made object and sort of suck up, you know, like psychically, it's all its attributes. He took it from me and he was spinning the wheel and going through the menus and, you know, and looking at every aspect of it. In about 45 seconds, there was a little tunnel between him and the iPod where he was like sucking up all the attributes. Then he handed it back to me and said, you know, this is a really good product. He said, and this is only for Macintosh?
Yeah. Well, it's taken him a few years and a couple of efforts, but now, Bill Gates and and Microsoft have entered the fray with Zune, their MP3 player.
That's right. Yeah, it took about 5 years for them to get to this point. They've had a few previous efforts, which they've pretty much abandoned now and left their users high and dry and come up with this idea, Zune, which really works on the iPod model, which is saying that this device is part of a big system integrated very seamlessly with computer software and a store. And it's all one, like a little three-part stool.
Right. Although it does have this beaming thing.
It's called squirting.
Squirting.
You squirt a song from one Zune to another.
Right. We'll see how fast that catches on. And if it does, you can bet that there'll be iPod squirts happening pretty soon, too. My guest is Stephen Levy. He's chief technology correspondent for Newsweek magazine. His book is The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. All right, it does shuffle. And you said before that allegedly it shuffles things completely at random. Your iPod seems to have a particular fondness, though, for Steely Dan.
That's right. My original iPod, you know, it would play a Steely Dan song, and then two songs later, there'd be another Steely Dan song. And then it wouldn't go too far before it would venture back into the Steely Dan catalog. And there just weren't that many Steely Dan songs on my library to justify this. So I wondered, is random really random?
So what happened? You go to did you go back to Steve Jobs and say, here's my iPod, it just plays Steely Dan at me all day long?
I actually did tell Steve Jobs about this, and he got an engineer on the phone and, you know, just swore up and down that random was random. But every person I talked to felt that their iPod played a favorite, whether if it wasn't Steely Dan, it was Patti Smith or the Beatles. And I wrote a column about it for Newsweek. I got unbelievable responses. People thought their iPods had weird preferences or were psychic, and no one really bought that it was random.
Yeah. Stephen, you've I mean, you've already mentioned having, you know, dinner with Bill Gates. You go to Steve Jobs' office and he immediately gets his tech support people talking about your iPod and it's not even broken. Your book looks like an eye. It's got the white cover and the wheel. The chapters can be shuffled, you know, different versions of the book will have. At what point do you worry about, you know, you're a journalist. At what point do you worry about being too close to your subject?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I have the, great privilege, in large part because I work for Newsweek and people return my calls, of getting to know these people. I've been writing about them before, even before I got to Newsweek 10 years ago. I've been covering technology for a long time. And, generally, I try to be balanced. In this book, I have to say, as an iPod lover, I wasn't going to embark on a thing saying, the iPod might be good in this case, but it's not good in that case. It's the smash product of the 21st century. It's not flawless, and I point out the flaws, and I talk about the guys who did the movie about how the battery ran down and things like that. But, to me, the iPod is something that added a lot of richness to my life and a lot of richness to a lot of people's lives. It's, a big metaphor. People talk about the iPod generation. It's had a big effect on culture. So I have to say, in the case of maybe not necessarily Apple or Steve Jobs, but in the iPod, I'm a fan, and you're going to hear some good things about the iPod in the book.
Mm-hmm. All right, now there are many other fans. I mean, the latest numbers are somewhere around 70 or 80 million iPods out there.
Right. I think there were as of a couple of weeks ago there were about 70. By the end of the year, I'm sure there'll be well over 80 million.
So that's a lot. But I mean, there's a lot of people in the world. There's almost 300 million just here in this country alone. So is it still kind of, even though the prices have come down, is it still sort of an elitist or maybe a status symbol kind of thing?
I'd say it's getting away. One thing about the iPod, and this has been unique for Apple, which has been pretty much a niche company to date, is that it has moved from like a BMW kind of product to a Toyota kind of product where, lots of people have it. It's not so unusual. Yet, it's managed to maintain its cachet while doing this, which is very unusual. And I think that's in part because Apple has that design skill. And they've also haven't stood still. The iPod now looks different than the iPod did when it was introduced. You look at the original iPod, and it looks like an SUV compared to the sleeker versions now, the Nano, which holds as many songs as the original iPod, yet is about less than 30% its bulk.
Right. And, of course, there are now the video ones that are slim and black. You've gotten away from the white, still have the wheel, still monochromatic. But as much as the iPod, it's been the unlooked for success of iTunes that has sort of been a driving force here.
That's right. iTunes, the software, along with the store that's built into the product there when you're connected to the internet, has changed the way we buy our music. And, you walk up the street, Tower Records is closing, and that's no coincidence. It's just so much more convenient to buy your music on the internet. It used to be pretty convenient to steal your music on the internet, but now the Apple's goal really has been to shift that and make it so easy to buy music that it's a bigger pain in the neck to steal it.
Which, of course, it was why Steve Jobs was met with, derision and ridicule when he first proposed the idea of selling music on the internet because people were downloading it for free. And yet this year they sold their 1 billionth with a B, 1 billionth song, and it was this one from Coldplay. Coldplay's Speed of Sound marked the 1 billionth sale of songs over Apple's iTunes. We're speaking about the iPod with author Stephen Levy of Newsweek. His book is The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and coolness. And you mentioned, Stephen, it has managed to maintain its image as a cool item, even as it's become almost de rigueur for everyone from teens to retirees. We actually got a nice email this morning from Mike, a listener who's 73 years old, says he doesn't go anywhere without his iPod and his Bose headphones. So he's got the BMW thing happening there. With 4 complete Wagner Ring cycles, 14 hours of Winston Churchill speeches, and practically every Smithsonian record out there, all loaded onto his iPod. So, you know, the other thing is, it seems to admit a wide variety of tastes.
That guy must have a wild shuffle experience.
Well, now, you know, the thing is, you know, we're talking about the thing, the iPod. But really, what drives the iPod and the iTunes is what you can do with it. It's the music. And have you had the experience that Mike has had of, you know, just loading stuff into the iPod and being unable to, clearly you have had this experience, you've written a whole book about it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what happens is the iPod, you have to look at in is really the symbol of the new age of digital music. And with the internet, with music blogs, with discovery sites, we're entering a period where it's going to be easier than ever to find new music and to get hold of it, you know, really, really in an easy way. And I think the music industry should embrace this process because, you know, we have the possibility to discover new bands more easily.
So name a band that you've discovered through your iPod.
Well, like say Of Montreal, that's one band. Band of Horses, mm-hmm. Mendocino Line. You know, these weird bands that I discover on music blogs or just like the following links, and then I just go buy the songs.
All right. Well, actually, here's a little bit from the band Of Montreal, and we've been speaking with Stephen Levy. His book is called The Perfect Thing: How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Stephen, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, John. Keep listening.
Let's pretend we don't exist. Let's pretend we're in Antarctica. Let's have bizarre celebrations. Let's forget when forget how. We'll have bizarre celebrations.
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.